Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 32 of season 3 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action movie Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is Matthew Simpson of Awesome Friday. Welcome back, Matthew.
Well, thank you for having me again. This has been really fun so far, so I'm looking forward to it.
All right, well, just keep your head. Just be careful what you like to do here. Or at least try. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So,
of course.
That's right. Minute 32 begins with Hans trying again to warn Takagi, and ends with Carl checking the door. So yesterday, we had a great minute with Takagi trying to weasel his way out of giving over this code, but at the same time, Hans is doing his best to make Takagi realize that it's in his best interest to probably give him the code. Mm-hmm. So, we ended yesterday's minute with Han saying to Takagi, "That's a very nice suit, Mr. Takagi." And today it continues with, "It would be a shame to ruin it." Now, that's a great threat.
Yeah.
It's subtle, but it's straight to the point.
Rickman is so good at delivering these lines with sort of this very casual venom, this very casual malice.
Yes.
It's not like overt. He doesn't like play it to 11. He's just like, it'd be a shame to ruin it. Like, it's kind of a shame he never got to play a Bond villain. He's so good at delivering these lines.
He doesn't need to be a Bond villain. He's Hans Gruber.
That's true. That's true. But I'm just saying, like, he knows exactly when to dial it up and when not to. And it's kind of a shame we don't get to see him dial it up in this minute or any of this week, but it pays off so well later when he does. Sure.
There's no question about that. And, I mean, he's just great in the way that he delivers his lines here and stuff like that. In some ways, he sounds like a parent trying to warn a child, and we aren't necessarily sure if he's going to follow through with the threat or not. With the way that...
Yeah, like a disappointed school headmaster?
Sort of. No, but the disappointed headmaster goes with Carl and Theo, not with Takagi.
True, yes.
And then Hans continues and says, "I'm going to count to three. There will not be a four. Give me the code. 1, 2, 3. And I love, as he's counting, the shot keeps changing. We get to see, we get to see Takagi sweating even more. We get to see, John looking over. And we get to see Carl and Theo, trying to, looking on as the count is also going on. And he begins, he's like holding his hand on the gun on the table the entire time. But that's it. He has his hand placed on the gun, but doesn't do anything beyond that. And
yeah, again, such wonderful casual threat. It's so well executed.
Yeah, for sure. And
pardon the
pun. Sure. and then Takagi goes, "I don't know. I'm telling you, get on a jet to Tokyo and ask the chairman. I'm telling you, you're just gonna have to kill me." So first of all, why should he tell him to get on a jet? Why don't you get on the phone?
I mean. Yeah, I'm assuming something to do with the time difference, or just maybe the chairman is esoteric and doesn't have a phone.
It could be. It's the 80s, so maybe he didn't have a cell phone at the time either. He has $640 million in bearer bonds that is chump change, but he doesn't have a cell phone. But what's great here, first of all, I did the math last week because, we discussed the fact that Takagi says to him, by the time they wake up in Tokyo, they're going to change the codes. So there's a 16-hour difference between LA and Tokyo. So if this is taking place, I guess, around 7 o'clock at night, okay, so it's 11 o'clock in the morning in Tokyo. So it's already morning.
Well, maybe he's just, we talked yesterday about how Takagi at this point is still trying to size up exactly who he's dealing with. And I think, he's realize he's not, that Gruber's not the terrorist he initially thought, but I think he's underestimating what that actually means. You know, like, I think he's perhaps, in realizing that Gruber's not a terrorist, he then begins to think he's less of a threat, right, which I find interesting.
Right. Do you think he's trying to buy time by saying this? I mean, I don't know if telling someone to kill me is going to really buy me time, but do you think that's what he's trying to do, even though it's not effective?
No, I think at this point he has made his assessment of Gruber and doesn't think that Gruber is going to follow through. I think he fully believes that Gruber's not going to follow through on his threat.
Well, apparently either Theo or Carl also believes that he's not going to follow through.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to later today. We'll figure out which one is wishing which. You know, but
yep.
I mean, it's just a silly statement to say, "Oh, you're just gonna have to kill me."
It is, but it betrays, like, again, it's said so confidently, and I think that James Shigeta,
I think, yeah, it's Shigeta,
yeah, is so, like, wonderfully confident in this moment, playing this CEO who's used to commanding the negotiations, who doesn't realize that maybe he's they're underestimating
a little bit in over his head.
Yeah, those are great puns.
Great adding these puns in about what we know is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, he's very headstrong.
Yes, there you go. Very good.
But
he's above the others.
indeed. I hope he doesn't lose his head in the negotiations. But yeah, I really like his performance in this moment of being very confident that he's in control and not really realizing that he's not.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty great moment, and we're only 32 minutes into the movie, but I've always found that character to be very memorable.
Yes.
Which says a lot about James Shigeta and the
movie. Yeah, because think about it. How many of the minutes is he in this movie? Let's say he's in 5 minutes, 7 minutes. I mean, he's not in that many minutes of the movie, but he leaves a very lasting impression, more so than many of the other characters around here.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons that Die Hard is pretty great, like we were talking about yesterday, is that all of the, or at least most of the supporting characters, get such fleshed out personalities. None of them are boring. None of them are flat. They're all fully formed characters. And it really, really works to make the whole film great.
Yeah. Completely. And I mean, the way that Hans responds here is great, because it's like, you don't expect it. It takes him 2 seconds, if not even that. He goes, okay.
No, not even. Just okay. Yeah.
Okay. And he picks up the gun and just shoots him.
Yeah. Ruins the suit.
Yes. I mean, it's a very quick and smooth shot. You know, right through, right between the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're a little graphic in the way that they show his brains on the window of the door.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is an R-rated movie, though.
You know, yeah, no, for sure. But I'm saying, but you also taking into consideration, this is the '80s, so this isn't a horror movie. In a horror movie, I can expect that.
Yeah, I mean.
But it's just very interesting that the boom and then the blast of the shot. I mean, again, it's the shock value. It's the shock John also into realizing who he's dealing with.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very effective shot.
It's very effective.
In both ways. You know, cinematically.
Yeah, I mean, we see it later in the movie also. It you know, every time they go through this boardroom later on, we're going to see those brains on, you know, they didn't get the clean lady to come to clean it up.
Yeah. Know. Yeah. Well, they had the doors locked, so that makes sense. But, it's
true.
It's an effective shot, and it's effective how it's left there. And you're right. It does really, you know, as much as Takagi had completely underestimated his opponent, it really lets John understand exactly who he's dealing with.
With, right?
And it also lets us,
which helps later on with the conversation with Ellis, where John basically says, "I know who we're dealing with here. You don't."
Yeah, and
I know these type of people. You don't. Yeah.
And for us, the audience, it also lets us know exactly who Alan Rickman is. And he does it so, again, just it's so casual, but so violent and malevolent.
Yes.
How he's just like, okay. And it really lets us know that Gruber is a man who is committed to this. Like, he may not be a terrorist, but he definitely has a cause and a mission that he wants to execute. And he's going to not let anything get in his way.
Right.
And, you know, if it, we talked yesterday about how he seemed to not... To prefer not to kill Takagi, but now we know that, you know, if that's the only option, he's just going to do it. You know, he's not going to hesitate if that's his choice.
Right, but I think he pretty much knew that the odds were that he wasn't going to give him the code.
No, I mean, for sure. I think for sure Gruber's expectation is almost certainly that, I think at best it was a 50-50 shot, right? Whether he was going to give up the code. Right. But I think I still, and maybe I'm just sympathizing with the bad guy too much here, but my feeling is that he would have preferred not to. But it shows his, you know, commitment to that as soon as it became the only option, he did it. No hesitation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But there's also the idea here that you know, when you're looking at the way things are playing out, you know, it's telling us, you know, that these guys mean business.
Yep.
You know, they're not people to take lightly and trifle with and whatever. And I love how we get the shot from John's perspective of the, you know, the window glass, and we see the all the brains there, and it's like literally the cut is seconds after Hans makes the shot. So if you look, you can actually see through the glass Hans's hand on the gun, but it doesn't look like it's actually lined up properly.
Oh, interesting.
Along with where the blood, you know, hits the, again, it could just be, you know, from my perspective that it's slightly off, but it doesn't look like, as if they got the angle.
You know, I was so focused on the blood spatter, the brain spatter, that I didn't actually notice that.
Well, I think that's the point. I think they want you to look at.
Yeah.
Look
it at is that, such a wonderfully know. Shocking moment in the movie. It really lets you know what kind of movie you're watching too. Not that it's going to be like necessarily graphically violent, but that, you know, people aren't safe either.
Right. And again, like the biggest question that I have is, okay, he shot him and there's blood now on the window, but how come the bullet didn't go through the window? You'd think that the glass would have shattered.
The answer is probably magic. A wizard did it. A wizard did it. That's the answer. Pretty sure.
A wizard did it. Okay.
In movies, if you can't explain it, a wizard did it. That's my,
Makes sense. I completely agree. You know, Gandalf. Yeah. Gandalf strikes.
Although I know, I should know this because I just rewatched this scene in the movie and also this minute of the movie. But it's entirely possible the bullet did pass through and it's just obscured by all the blood and guts.
But it didn't. It didn't shatter it. You'd think that the bullet would shatter the glass.
You'd think. I'm really reaching here, to be fair, but it's.
No, I understand.
Yeah,
I understand. That's fine. I didn't expect you to have an answer. It's just it's the idea of being able to point these things out so that people can know that you know that you and I are actually.
I mean, the actual answer is that,
you know,
the scene wouldn't be as effective if the glass shattered and the blood didn't hit it and stay there.
Yeah, of course. That is the true answer. And again, maybe the bullet is still entrenched somewhere in what's left of his head, you know, and the rest of it just blurted out. I mean, I don't know enough about ballistics to really explain that. So we'll just have to, the suspension of disbelief there. So we clearly see that McClane is shocked by all this, and then we get to see Hans stand up, and you know the chair basically falls over with the body inside of it, you know, perfectly, you know, strapped to the chair, I guess you can say. And you can see like there's still smoke in the air from the, you know, from the
yeah, such a nice little detail. I love when they
stuff like that.
You know, because in yes. nowadays they could just add that in post, but back then they would have really had to think about that and like have something to create the smoke for multiple takes
yeah.
or you know, some practical little piece. I love that.
At this point, Hans decides to start you know, giving out little missions to everyone to do different jobs. He goes, "We'll have to do it the hard way, Tony. See if you can dispose of that," pointing to the body. And then he goes, "Carl, you better go and check on Heinrich working on the machine floor. You know, it's like you do this, you do that, and whatever." And you know, from at this point, we see Carl handing Theo some money. So basically, what it comes down to is that Theo believed that Hans was going to shoot him, and Carl didn't. Now we both know that Carl is a little more is much more sadistic than Theo. So it's fun that they have this role reversal, you know, because it's not a question of Carl betting whether he's going to shoot him. It's a question of whether Hans is going to shoot him. So Carl doesn't apparently trust Hans enough to believe that he actually would shoot him. Do you think they're betting
on whether
Hans would
shoot him, or do you think they're betting on whether Takagi would give up the code, though? Because that was my read, that they weren't, that they were. I mean, I think they would both
What's
understand that if Takagi didn't give up the code, he was going to get shot, right? But if they're betting on whether Takagi would cave rather than whether Gruber would actually, then Hans would actually shoot him. Was sort of my read on it. Like they were betting on Takagi, not on Hans, was my read.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't think of it from that perspective because that changes things completely because, you know, that means that Theo believes that Takagi is going to rather die than give over the code and that Carl believes that he will give over the code. Or sorry, that he won't give over the code.
Theo believes
Did I get that right? So Theo believes that he will that Takagi will go to his grave before giving over the code, and Carl believes that he will give up.
It does kind of change things,
right? Okay, it really does. That's interesting. I still like looking at it from the perspective that they're betting on Hans, but I can see where you're going with betting on Takagi really also
spoken about. So I think it's. Yeah. Whichever way you want to read it is fine. And I just think they're both interesting to think about.
And at this point, you know, John decides to try to get out of there, and he makes a little noise and bumps his head or bumps his arm on the on the table, and all four of the villains quickly just turn and look over, and Carl pulls out a gun, and then Carl and Tony both run into the room. Searching for someone that's you know making the noise or whatever intruder has shown here, and I love the music. You know, Michael Kamen does a great job with the music in this movie. And this, you know, as soon as they come in, you get a few notes, you know, that adds the suspense of everything like that. And then we see Carl run to check, and he opens a set of doors and looks in.
No.
I mean, he doesn't do it in a very secure way. You know, he just like opens the door. Instead of, you know, having someone cover him or having the gun, you know, looking at what's going to happen there or anything like that.
Yeah, he definitely kind of flings them open, doesn't he?
Yes. And then he tries to go to a second door, and we see him try and turn the handle, and that's where the minute ends.
Yeah, it's a pretty great minute, to be fair. Like, there's a lot of great minutes in this film, but this is one of them, for sure.
Yeah. Actually, what do you mean? Every minute is a great minute in this movie.
True. It is a classic.
Can you think of can you honestly think of something in this movie that happens that you say to yourself, "Oh, that's boring. I don't want to see that. Why is that here?" You know, everything is building up the story and is telling us so much about these characters and the situation as things are moving along.
There are no wasted frames in this movie at all. Like everything we see.
I wouldn't go that far. I'm sure there are. I wouldn't say there aren't wasted frames, but there are no wasted scenes.
Yeah, like every scene definitely tells us something that we're going to need to know or informs something that's going to happen later, for sure.
Right. Right. Exactly. Like, I mean, I remember reading online someone complaining about the fact that why do they keep cutting to Argyle? You know, like, what does that add to us? You know, why didn't John just go down and use the, you know, meet up with Argyle and use the, you know, his cell phone or something?
Really?
You know?
That seems like, I mean, but, the elevators are shut down. They're on the 30th floor. And Argyle's in the basement. It's not.
Yeah, I think he would have. He would have been able to get there if he wanted.
I mean, yeah, maybe.
You know, but again, then yeah, we wouldn't have this movie.
Wouldn't exist.
So
yeah.
Why would we do that? Exactly. So the script has a few little discrepancies here. Not that many, but so Hans at the beginning says, "This is too nice a suit to ruin, Mr. Mm-hmm. Takagi." So, you know, they change around the words a little bit. That could have just been an ad lib from Alan Rickman about how that. And Takagi says, "I don't know it. Get on the goddamn jet to Tokyo and ask the chairman." Now, adding the word goddamn in that particular situation makes it seem, rightfully so, that Takagi is much more agitated. And he's not, you know, he still speaks calmly, even though he's sweating and everything like that. But if you were to have him swear in the middle, it would be a little too much. So
I 100% agree with that. Maybe if it was like a European company and he was like the American CEO, like a white guy, it would make sense. But it,
yeah,
like a Texan or a New Yorker or anyone from any of those places. But as the Japanese CEO of a Japanese company, whether or not it's culturally accurate, it does not feel movie authentic for him to be swearing, which is why I'm glad they didn't do that.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And then it says that, you know, after the shot, it says McLean reacts as if he is shot. And it says the glass doors up to the boardroom are splattered red and dripping. Takagi is still seated, but the chair is flat on its back, blood flowing out into the carpet. Hans springs to his feet. And then I'm not going to go into the dialogue because the dialogue is the same thing. And then it says, Carl, in the midst of handing Theo a $50 bill, nods. So it was a $50 bet. This isn't a Trading Places, you know, bet.
Yeah.
Where they're just betting a dollar.
It was only 10.
There you go. Exactly. And then it says outside, McLean stunned, sees Hans move and tries to retreat, but his gun bumps the underside of the table. And then, you know, Carl and Tony run out after him. So again, there aren't that many differences between the script, but I always like seeing the small little differences because you can try to figure out, okay, are these differences because, you know, someone scripted them that way? And they decided to, you know, on the spot to change something, or is it an ad lib or whatever it is? So it's, you know, in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, we basically had over 2 hours of cut footage. So there was a lot from the script. You know, it was, they basically cut out Die Hard because it was 2 hours and 12 minutes that was cut out of the first cut until the final cut.
That is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. That's a lot of movie to cut down.
It's nuts, but it's very interesting to see all the things that they cut, you know. But in this type of movie, it's a lot shorter.
Yeah,
the type of cuts that they get. What can you do? All right. So every Tuesday we do a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition. So where my guest will give a story about an adventure or misadventure or something that happened during some sort of holiday. Holiday could be a vacation. Holiday could be, you know, a holiday, whatever.
Well, so
what have you got for us, Matthew?
It's now a pretty popular thing that Die Hard is a Christmas movie, right? And I've gone back and forth on that in my entire life, whether it's a Christmas movie or a movie set at Christmas. But either way, it's a movie that takes place at Christmas. But like 15 years ago, so this is be late zeros. This is sort of before that really became a hugely popular idea. There was a theater here in Vancouver where I live that on the last Friday of every month, they just did a repertory show. So rather than something new, they had like a voting system, and they would bring in prints of old movies to watch. So, you know, one day it would be Raiders of the Lost Ark, and another one I saw there was Aliens. It was really cool theater. And I think it was during Raiders in November of whatever year that was, 2009, I think, 2008. The movie finished, and always finished with the host coming out and thanking everyone for being there, and there was always giveaways and stuff. And as he's talking, he announces that, you know, they're going to start thinking about what to do for Christmas. And I'm there with my friend Simon, who is my podcasting partner to this day. And we both sort of just looked at one another and then, like, almost in unison yelled out, "Die Hard for Christmas!" And the guy was like, "Wait, what?" And then someone else was like, "Yeah, Die Hard for Christmas!" And everyone started applauding. And then 30 days later, on Christmas Day, we watched Die Hard in a theater in Vancouver because we called it out, which felt pretty good.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. That's a great story.
Yeah. Short but sweet.
All right. So, hey, why not? Nothing wrong with that. Short, long, doesn't matter, as long as it's a good story. That's the important thing. All right. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you once again?
Absolutely. As always, the easiest way to find my stuff is to go to our website, which is awesomefriday.ca. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at awesomefridayca and Facebook Awesome Friday. Our main output these days is the Awesome Friday podcast, where we review two new things, usually movies, every week. And you can find that anywhere you can listen to podcasts.
All right, very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, or you can go to my website. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.